Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. Today is March 30th, 2016. The markets were up today. The Dow closing at 17,716, the NASDAQ at 4869, and the S&P at 2063, I think is what I wrote. Tonight, we have a full show. We have a guest this evening as well. But I want to let you know right off the top, I know it's a lovely, gorgeous evening. But if you have not finished your income tax return yet, tonight would be a great night to start that. And if you have questions, the lines are open. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. We are live. Judy Ann's in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I'll do my best to answer them. In between your questions, we are going to be discussing unusual tax situations or transactions to kind of fill in the air. But obviously, we love your calls. So again, if you have questions, and you can talk on air or off air, whatever's more comfortable for you, the number is 610-758-8810, and questions could also be sent through the website yourfinancialchoices.com. I do have a guest this evening, a voice you will be very familiar with because he's my go-to fill-in host, Rod Young, CPA,
hey, Lori.
CFP. Hi, Rod. And Rod's going to help go through some unusual tax situations, or at least some tax situations that we want to alert you to. And of course, we will also take questions, and Rod will help answer some of those questions you have. Rod is, as I mentioned, a CPA CFP. He's also a financial advisor with Valley National Financial Advisors and senior vice president, and runs Executive Edge. So Rod is quite comfortable and used to talking with executives and handling unusual tax situations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What else would you like to share with the audience? There, we might have new listeners, Rod, now because we increased our listening.
That's great.
Capability, I should say.
Well, it's great to be back, Lori, and I always love doing the show with you. You know, we've been together now, I think, 8 years, a little over eight
yeah.
years.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So we, you know, got a history now, and mm-hmm. like you, CPA, Certified Financial Planner, and just excited to be here tonight to help people with their tax questions.
No, Rod's excited to be here tonight because we're not having to do tax returns
right.
while we're here.
We are out of the office.
Which is really nice on this lovely night. So again, folks, if you have questions, we are happy to take those calls, 610-758-8810. So in between, Rod, what kind of tax situations have you seen come up that we might want to alert our listeners to pay attention
oh gosh
for their own situations?
There's so many. Where do we begin? Why don't we start with maybe a pretty basic one, and I don't know how unusual it is, but I do think it's important to bring it to people's attentions. We'll talk about those foreign tax credits that we report on tax returns, and they can be generated in a variety of different ways. And actually, probably more people have foreign income than realize that they have foreign income.
Right. And years ago, we probably didn't see it very often. And now with the way investments are...
With the growth of the mutual fund investment industry and people investing in not just U.S. stock funds, but also mm-hmm. overseas stock funds, many, many people have foreign-sourced income, mm-hmm. interest, dividends, capital gains, and may not even realize it, but they're paying taxes to a foreign country on that income, and that they can use that on their tax return.
So let's talk about a couple different situations where someone might have that foreign income, and where do they look for that in their investments?
Sure, they would look for that, and the most common place they're going to see it will be on a 1099 form that they receive from their investment custodian that reports their interest, dividends, and capital gains. And typically right on the kind of the summary page, I'll call it, of a 1099, where they report the gross dividends and how much of those dividends were qualified, what were capital gain distributions, there'll be a box on there. There'll be an amount that says foreign tax paid.
And then the foreign tax paid will apply just to the foreign income for that particular tax, and people have to kind of pay attention to those numbers as well?
Yeah, they have to really, it's not just looking at the first page of the form, but those documents, those 1099 documents are, we see them, every day. They're 20, 30 pages long, and so embedded into the details, typically there'll be several pages of details on the dividends that were paid. And you'll be able to see from that detail which of the dividends had foreign tax withheld. And so somehow you have to figure out when you're reporting it on your tax return how to add up. You have to add up all that foreign sourced income.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add up, you've been given the total on the foreign dividends, and you have to get that. There's a form 1116 where you report this foreign sourced income and the amount of dividend, amount of tax you paid on that income. And then it kind of flows through, and it's an actual dollar for dollar, for most people, a dollar for dollar tax credit against their federal income tax.
That's what I love. And a lot of people might just, glaze over that when they're looking at their 1099. They might not pay attention to it because they don't know where it goes, or they think it's complicated. But some of those foreign tax credits can add up.
That's, oh, absolutely. I mean, we're not talking $10 or $20 here. We can be talking hundreds of mm-hmm. dollars of tax credits
mm-hmm.
here. So definitely worth paying very close attention to your 1099 forms.
So especially, folks, if you're doing your own tax return, you want to pay attention to that in particular. And if you are paying a preparer to do that, you just want to glance over on page 2. If you know that you had foreign tax dividends, glance on page 2 to see if you see a tax credit. And if you don't see it, go look for that form 1116. And if you don't see that, then that might be something worthwhile looking at. Now, if someone doesn't have any tax due, then there's no use of the credit and you're not going to see it. It's not a refundable credit.
Correct. But then if that happens, if you don't use all of that credit that you're entitled to in the year, you actually are permitted to carry that credit forward to a future tax year. So what happens? So perhaps in the next tax year, you have some foreign sourced income again, mm-hmm. pay some foreign tax credit, and use up all that tax credit from the current year, you mm-hmm. can then, if the calculation works out in your favor, use up some of that carry forward credit from the prior year.
So you also want to make sure that if you're switching tax preparers and you do have any carry forward information, whether it's foreign tax credits or capital losses, you want to make sure you carry forward that information. We also want to point out that, as Rod said, more and more people have that foreign income within their mutual funds and investments that they have here in the United States. There may be circumstances where you have foreign income and accounts outside of the United States. So we want to talk about that briefly when we come back. If you have questions, we're here for your We're here to answer them.
Absolutely.
610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets, on the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station.
And welcome back. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. I have in the studio with me this evening Rod Young, CPA, CFP, and Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor at Valley National Financial Advisors. If you have tax questions this evening, the lines are open, 610-758-8810. You can call in and ask questions live on air or off air, whatever is more convenient for you. And in between times, we are talking about some items to be aware of, and one of those was foreign tax credits. Rod, we talked about looking on those 1099s of your brokerage statements when people are diversified and they will have some foreign holdings, international positions within their brokerage account. Typically, we're going to see some foreign taxes, and we want folks to make sure they're reporting any foreign taxes that they paid, because they may get a dollar-for-dollar offset against their U.S. tax that they've paid on that. So those are foreign tax credits. Some folks we're seeing more and more in this global society of people, you know, moving here and living here, and people who maybe have come here from foreign lands, or their parents are still in foreign countries and maybe they inherit accounts. Sometimes we still see actual foreign accounts.
Absolutely.
Like literally accounts held in foreign countries, not just in their mutual funds. A lot of people get that confused. What are some items that they have to pay attention to for those kinds of accounts?
Sure. First and foremost, you have to, if those accounts are over a certain dollar amount, you have to disclose those accounts. And there's reporting forms for disclosing the existence of a foreign asset that, you know, that you own. Other, you know, typically when you have a foreign account, you'll get if you have a statement for that account, it's denominated in a foreign currency. So you have to be able to translate that foreign currency, convert it to U.S. dollars when reporting its existence on a U.S. income tax return.
And there still might be foreign taxes that we see on those statements as well.
Absolutely.
Possibly. Yep. So, and when we're looking at conversion, sometimes the income may be converted as of December 31st, but if there's sales transactions, purchases, sales, you want to look at the conversions on the
conversion on those actual days.
And it can make a difference, folks, too. So
absolutely. And one other thing we see, not quite as often, but people who are actually maybe on an overseas assignment and being paid overseas, and that's a totally different type of income that we're talking about now. You know, now they have earned income from overseas. But if you're a U.S. citizen, as you know, you are required to report on a U.S. tax return your worldwide income. So it doesn't matter that you happen to be working overseas. And that adds an additional level of complexity to the foreign tax reporting. And we're seeing more and more of that. The world's getting smaller.
Right. So folks, watch out for those things. When we talk about foreign tax credits, other places they might land might be a K-1. And K-1s are in and of themselves their own little creatures. And we are also seeing more and more of those. So what kinds of things do people have to pay attention to when we're looking at K-1 reporting?
Sure. There's actually a number of things. First of all, I think there's many people out there who are holding investments in their investment accounts, and we see more and more of this, that don't even know that they're going to be receiving a K-1. They've invested in what's known as a publicly traded partnership. It's almost like owning a stock, but it's not a stock. And your tax reporting for that is going to be on a K-1. So what you have to look out for is typically your 1099 packet that we talked about earlier will list for you what K-1s you can expect.
So okay. It's buried in that 20-page document, and it might behoove the folks to kind of glance through that before they drop off their tax information to their accountant.
Absolutely. And the other problem with these K-1s is they typically come arrive much later than the 1099 packets. So, you know, if you're not aware that you have it and you've given all your information to your accountant doesn't know there's going to be a K-1, prepares the tax return, gets it all signed, sealed, delivered, you file it, and guess what? K-1 arrives, mm-hmm. And you're putting a call into your accountant saying, I have another tax document here. Well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. Mm-hmm. And
well, you hope your accountant will look at that document, too. And some, well, those of us who are used to looking at them will see it. But there are sometimes accountants who just do kind of same as last year, and may not pick that up.
Or it's not listed on the 1099 packet that you're going to be receiving it. So,
okay.
Yeah,
typically, we've been seeing them.
Typically, we see it. They're getting better and better at listing them in those packets.
Right. But one of the things that I see happen is sometimes the client will think they're helping and only give you the pages they think that have important information
like
on it.
They have numbers on.
Right. So, folks, keep all of your tax documents intact, because it could be that page 19 of 20 that might have that important information.
Sure.
Okay. And the K-1s, those can be bought and sold, and there's other kind of adjustments and figures that have to be computed. So you have to be very careful when you're buying and selling those K-1s, you know, the MLPs, Master Limited Partnerships, and things like that as well.
We just worked on one earlier today. I didn't do the actual work on it. One of our associates did, and we talked about it. There were 18 K-1s, transactions of buying and selling, and just for the K-1s, it was almost 3 hours of work to put that information into the tax return. That's just for the K-1s. And many times, these K-1s are reporting very, very small, inconsequential dollar amounts. And so it was several hours of work for what turned out to be literally, you know, a couple hundred dollars of tax data.
Yeah.
So they're complex documents.
So you want to pay attention to those when you're working with a financial advisor who might be going in and out of master limited partnerships and things like that.
Yes.
Something also that we see from time to time on 1099s might be stock options that have traded. We have, you know, some folks who maybe are given stock awards, and that value is typically included in their W-2.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have the right to participate in an employee stock purchase plan,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where you buy stock at a discount, but it could involve certain, you know, buys and sells of different kind of stocks, and then non-qualified stock options.
Sure.
So it's a little complicated for the show, but what might be a couple items just to kind of keep your eyes open if you are someone who might work for a company that offers these kinds of incentives?
Sure, and these are typically offered by larger companies, and, you know, locally in the Lehigh Valley here, you would see that maybe with an Air Products or a PPL or some of the larger companies here. The things to look out for and understand regarding those are, what is your cost basis regarding any shares that are transacted and reported on a 1099? As you alluded to earlier, if you're granted shares of restricted stock that eventually vest, the value when the stock vests is on your W-2. That's your cost basis. And you want to make sure that you understand that that is your cost basis, and that's also your starting point for your holding period to determine whether it's short or long-term capital gain.
Okay.
So those are very important things to look out for. With stock options, non-qualified stock options, we see quite a bit of these, and there's the reporting regarding non-qualified stock options has changed over the past 2 years, and so now there are significant adjustments that may need to be reported on your Schedule D. So with a non-qualified stock option, it gives you the right to buy stock at a certain price. And if the market value of the stock is, you know, significantly higher than the price you pay for it, that difference is reported on your W-2 as income. But the sale of the stock, the exercise of the stock option, is then also reported on this 1099 packet that you're going to receive. And if you don't understand what it is that you're looking at, you could inadvertently report a capital gain on your Schedule D that's already been included as compensation as wages on your W-2. So you really, it's very important to understand how these stock options are being being reported.
Great. Folks, if you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
As you might have heard, we are gearing up for our 2016 Spring Pledge Drive, starting Friday, April 1st. No joke. If we can raise $17,000 before April 1st, we'll push back the start of the drive by 3 days. That will give us a pledge-free weekend. We have just $5,000 left to go. Help us keep the drive short. Make your donation today at WDIY.org. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert, CPA, CFP, and I have in the studio with me this evening, Rod Young, CPA, CFP, and a financial advisor at Valley National Financial Advisors, and we are talking taxes. If you have questions, need to get that tax return done, maybe you're just not quite sure about something, maybe we could steer you in the right direction. If you
I know
like
there's people out there with questions.
Don't be afraid to call. We love questions. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. If you don't want to talk live on air, you can give your question to Judy Ann. She'll write it down and bring it into the studio. And if you want to talk live on air, just let us know.
Lori, I have a question.
Okay.
Sometimes politicians talk about going to a flat tax. Now, if that were to happen, would you have no callers tonight because there are no questions to ask?
I'm sure there would be all kinds of different nuances of any kind of a flat tax. Yeah. It's not going to be... people say there is still a flat tax. It's called the alternative minimum tax.
Right.
In some respects. And we're getting more and more toward that as well as it hadn't been increased for inflation for years and years. Now they
finally are adjusting it. Yep.
Yeah, but we do see more and more people subject to alternative minimum tax. And that
and
in
there's
a
only
way,
there's only two tax brackets with the alternative minimum tax. It's a flat 26 or a flat 28%. So there's some nuances of that already in the tax code.
Right. And then the lucky people who aren't subject to it because they're in the highest bracket, they don't have to worry about that little old alternative minimum tax because they're already in the top bracket.
I would welcome, John, I would welcome simplification, but I think even with simplification, there's still going to be some level of complexity. I agree with Lori.
Mm-hmm. So, folks, if you have questions, 610-758-8810. It's a beautiful, lovely evening, but we don't want to save all the calls till the end. And during tax season, we've been pretty steady at getting questions. And we have one now. It's off air. It's Jeff in Nazareth. Carry over losses. Can you explain this more? Great question, Jeff. And these are some of the great tax benefits we do enjoy. So, yeah. Rod, you want to talk about carryover losses?
Sure. And
we have a couple different kinds.
Yes, there's a couple different kinds. I'll start with what I believe is probably the focus of the question, which is the carryover of capital losses. And those are the carryover losses that we see the most, Jeff. So hopefully I'm answering the question that you're asking. So with capital losses, so basically, you know, at the end of the year, you add up, as you're preparing your tax return, you add up all your capital gains from the stocks you buy and sell, mutual funds you buy and sell. So add up all your gains, add up all your losses, offset them. Two categories, short-term, long-term, depending on whether the transaction was for something that was held for less than 12 months or more than 12 months. The net of all that, if it is a loss, and if that you can take a loss of up to $3,000 if you're married filing a joint return, you can take up to $3,000 of net capital loss, against other sources of income on your tax return in a given year. So your salary, your interest
income.
Yeah, the best
kind of income.
The best kind. That's right. And if your net loss after you add up all those transactions is more than $3,000, you get to carry forward that loss to the next tax year. It retains its character. If it's net short-term loss, it gets carried forward as short-term loss. If it's net long-term loss, it gets carried forward as long-term, and then you can use that loss in the next year to offset capital gains in that next year. And if there's still, after all the netting in the next year, more than a $3,000 loss, you carry it forward to the year after that until you've used it all. And the great thing about it, Jeff, is it doesn't expire.
Right.
You get it until you've used it all. And it's not uncommon back in the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, where people had significant capital losses, and we're starting to see most of those being used up within the past 2 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, people carrying forward significant losses for years and years until they've used them.
And I'll add a couple other things. That is for federal purposes. As a resident of Pennsylvania, unfortunately, we don't get to carry forward those losses at all. And we actually, if we have a loss in one category of income, cannot offset it against another class of income.
And the same applies in New Jersey as well.
No
carry forward like that.
Very good. Yep. And also, people have to keep in mind when they're doing their tax planning, it's not just your sales of mutual funds or stock. It could also be capital gain distributions.
Absolutely. They're reported as long-term capital gains on your tax return.
So if on Schedule D, you know, you think, oh, I had these losses, I'm going to use them against some gains, I'm going to sell some things and take some gains, you can't forget about the mutual funds that might put out some capital gain distributions too in your planning.
That's correct, except on, as you know, in Pennsylvania, the capital gain distribution doesn't get categorized as capital gain or loss. It's reported as a dividend.
Right. So it won't help you there either. They just take it and take it and take it.
So, Jeff, call back if you weren't asking about capital losses, and we could talk about passive losses.
Well, I do want to mention passive losses because we talked about K-1s and these master limited partnerships. So one of the things that happens with these publicly traded partnerships is you get these K-1s, and they'll have these losses on them that you won't be able to take because you're a limited partner and they're passive and you typically won't be able to take them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're suspended. And they're suspended until either you have passive income to offset or until you dispose of the activity. So passive losses also can carry forward, but usually when we dispose of the activity, they're freed up.
That's right.
And it could be a real tax planning strategy to make sure you're aware of what those are in case you have other income you want to, you know, accelerate onto your tax return if you know you're going to have some passive losses suspended. And that could be with rental properties as well. And that's where we see the really, really big passive losses.
That's right. I just had one of those recently where years and years of rental passive loss carry forwards that were able to be fully offset against significant, you know, salary income to the point where the income tax on the tax return was zero.
So for people who have rental properties, if you're thinking about selling, you might want to make sure that you're figuring that in your long-term planning. If you're going to retire and you have these huge suspended passive losses, you might want to think about selling that rental property before you retire so that you have enough money
income
to take advantage of.
Yeah, or remember to do something like a Roth conversion.
There
to take
you go.
Advantage.
We love Roth conversions.
So talk to you. If you're going to sell an activity that has significant passive loss carry forwards, make sure you're talking to your tax advisor about how how it's all going to flow through on your tax return.
Yeah, sometimes those rental losses the IRS does allow. If you're under certain income thresholds, you can use up to $25,000 currently. But sometimes we have folks who are over those thresholds, and that's one of the reasons they're suspended. We are at the halfway point. If you have questions, and we love questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We can take your questions live on air or off air, as Jeff called in and asked. So again, 610-758-8810. We'll be back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
You're tuned to WDIY Allentown, your NPR community station in the Lehigh Valley. Lehigh Valley weather tonight, a low around 40 degrees. Tomorrow, Thursday, mostly sunny with a high near 69 and breezy in the afternoon. Could get wind gusts as high as 31 miles an hour. Thursday night, a 60% chance of showers, low around 57. For Friday, an 80% chance of showers, possibly a thunderstorm, high near 70, and wind gusts as high as 26 miles an hour. Friday night, a 30% chance of showers, low around 46. For Saturday, a slight chance of showers after 9 a.m., but partly sunny with a high near 57. Saturday night, a low of 32 degrees. And now we continue with your financial choices and your host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, John. Folks, if you have questions this evening, tax or otherwise, the phone number is 610-758-8810. I have in the studio with me this evening Rod Young, CPA, CFP, and financial advisor at Valley National Financial Advisors, and we are talking taxes tonight. Rod, we were just briefly going over some other situations, like we talked about foreign tax credits and carry forwards with those, K-1s and some of the activity that we see there, stock options, and then Jeff's call regarding carryover losses, which could be capital losses, and we briefly touched on passive losses. Since we're talking about carryovers, are there any other carryovers that people should kind of keep their eyes open for?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a number of carryovers, but the ones we see the most, in addition to what we've just talked about, Lori, we see investment interest expense, which is an itemized deduction on your Schedule A if you have something called investment interest expense, which is where if you've borrowed against your and use the proceeds of that borrowing to buy stocks or bonds that, you know, buy investments that produce taxable investment income or potentially capital gains. And so there's rules that limit the amount of investment interest that you can deduct in a particular year. And if you don't get to deduct all of your investment interest expense, you get to carry it forward to the following year and go through the same calculation all over again, similar to those capital losses. Mm-hmm. The other one we see is charitable contributions. You get to carry forward. There's limitations on how much charitable contribution you can deduct in a year, and if you don't get to use it all, you get to carry it forward. That's not an unlimited time period carry forward like those capital losses. That's a 5-year carry forward on the charitable contributions. Those are the typical carryovers that we're seeing.
So speaking of charitable contributions, let's talk about charitable contributions for a moment.
Sure.
So we have folks who donate cash, they write their check out to WDIY for $100 or go online, and that's a typical kind of contribution, or they make their church contribution. There are other kinds of contributions that folks can make to charity.
Sure.
And get some additional benefits. Can we talk about those for a minute?
Sure. We see a number of these throughout, you know, the course of the year, but donating property rather than donating cash, or making direct charitable gifts from your IRA if you're at that magic age where you're in required distribution mode.
And I want to talk a lot about that. So first talk about donating the appreciated property, and then I want to come back to the charitable, qualified charitable distribution from the IRA.
Sure. And so in terms of donating, you know, property, what we see the most are people donating clothing and household items, furnishings, appliances. We're seeing more and more automobile donations. You can donate stock in a company, and it's a great tax strategy if you have an appreciated stock and you want to donate that to a charity and you don't you know, as long as it's a long-term asset, you can deduct it at its fair market value and never pay tax on the gain.
And in fact, what happens sometimes is people are afraid to, like when they're rebalancing their portfolio and they have a position that's just grown so much, they're afraid to sell it because they don't want the tax consequence. Not that the tax consequences are that high these days, but they might not want that extra tax on their return. But if they're charitably inclined, that's a win-win.
Instead of writing a check to that charity, arrange for your investment advisor to transfer shares of your most highly appreciated stock to the charity.
And it doesn't have to be the full position. It can be some value dollar amount.
We do it every year where we'll say, I want to make a $3,000 donation to my church. Okay, let's pick the stock that we want to donate, we'd identify the number of shares, and it's a relatively simple process to make the donation.
And the charity has typically a brokerage account. It's just an electronic transfer.
Sure.
Quite easy.
Absolutely. And we are seeing a lot of automobiles, and there's new reporting over the past couple of years on automobile donations.
Right.
There's this 1099C. Thank you. Yes, and so that'll report to you what the charity ultimately sold the vehicle for.
Right. So the caution there is sometimes people will think their car's worth $4,000 and they're going to get a $4,000 deduction, and then they sell your Herbie Bug, and they sell it for $500, and that's what you get the deduction for.
Right, but there are circumstances, and there's a great publication on this. It's IRS publication 4303, which is all about donating your car. And if you believe the car you donated was worth more than what the charity sold it for, if you have an appraiser, qualified appraiser, appraise that car. You can, and there's a separate form on the tax return that the appraiser would have to sign.
Yeah.
You can take the donation, but the typical donation is going to be based on what the charity ultimately sold the car for.
Or they can actually use the vehicle in their service as well if they're using it for maybe transporting parishioners, or I think even if the clergy ends up using it.
Correct.
Then it has different valuation as well. So I want to talk about qualified charitable distributions, because I think this is a huge opportunity that many people may not be aware of, even though we've talked about it a number of times on this show.
Yes.
Next to the Roth IRA, it's like one of my favorite things. But I want to give the phone number one more time, 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. So there's something that we, in our accountant speak, we say QCD, and it's a qualified charitable distribution. Let's talk about that for a minute, Rod, and why that can be powerful for a lot of people, especially older people who might not have enough money to itemize and things like that.
Sure.
Deductions.
So the advantage of this, and this is, I think there's actually a lot of misunderstanding about the advantage of this this strategy, but the strategy basically allows, if you're 70 and a half, and if you're at that, so you're at that age where you are in your required minimum distribution years, you can direct that a certain amount, up to $100,000, can go directly from your IRA to a charity rather than coming to you first. And in that instance, it doesn't show up as income, gross income, on your tax return, and it does not then show up, it also does not show up as a deduction on Schedule A of your tax return. But the huge benefit is that it's not showing up as income on the front page of Form 1040, because there are so many items of income and deduction that are impacted by the amount of gross income that you report on a tax return. So if suddenly you have a required minimum distribution, let's say it's $25,000, and you designate that to go to a charity, and you pull that $25,000 of income off the tax return, all of these things, maybe it affects the how much of your Social Security benefits would be taxable. Mm-hmm. Those itemized deductions that are phased out because of your adjusted gross income, they can be affected. Or if you're typically the whole standard deduction, it can help you there. So
if someone does not normally itemize, they've paid off their house, their real estate taxes aren't that high, they're not working anymore, they're retired, they're 70 and a half or mm-hmm. older, and so they don't have the big tax deduction, they don't have the big mortgage interest deduction, maybe they're healthy and they don't have a big medical deduction, they may benefit more from a tax perspective by using the standard deduction. Hence, they are not getting any benefit from their charitable contributions
right.
at all,
yep.
even if they still are donating. So using this strategy is absolutely going to save them taxes.
Perfect for them. If they've, you know, take a couple $1,000, that mm-hmm. doesn't put them over that standard deduction threshold where they can itemize.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and not have that income on the first page of the tax return absolutely helps them.
I just looked at this today for someone, and just taking $2,500 off of page one, so they're not going to get the deduction on Schedule A. They were very close to, you know, just being able to itemize mm-hmm. anyway. So, but by taking that off page one, as you said, the Social Security inclusion came down. So that was really nice. Where else it might affect people too is sometimes when people are in required minimum distribution stages and they have large IRAs, they might watch that AGI, that page one income, because if their threshold gets over $170,000, now their Medicare premiums are going to go up. So as Rod said, there's so many things that are impacted by that income on page one that if there's a way yep. that you can kind of play with that a little bit, it's a and it doesn't have to be your whole required minimum distribution.
Absolutely not.
It could be
any amount of it. Yeah.
Okay, up to $100,000. So it's a great strategy to use.
And that's one of those ones where every year, as you know, Lori, it was set to expire or had expired and finally, they've made that permanent.
And I'm expecting that now that they've made it permanent, that we're going to see some coding, hopefully, maybe on the 1099-R where it shows that distribution, because right now
we don't know.
The taxpayer has to know
and has to tell the
tax preparer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So usually we're the ones who are telling them to do it, but
right. So we should know.
So we can kind of keep an eye out for it. But sometimes we don't know or how much they're doing because they get so excited about it and they start going crazy with it and donating to everybody. I do caution people, though, you don't want to do this for your $25 or $200 ones, for sure. And I would imagine custodians of IRAs are probably going to eventually have to have some kind of limit because it's just administratively burdensome to do it for like every $100 check.
Right.
But what I also suggest to folks is, why don't you pick a favorite charity and do like $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000, or in some cases it might be $100,000.
Sure. Yep.
So that and the $100,000 ones you can kind of do, you know, $10,000 at a time. And I have clients who do $1,000 at a time, but who do it for their entire required minimum distribution.
Right. Right.
So it's really a nice feature for the charities. And it's really nice for folks to take that income off page one. The other thing is, I thought when this first came out that the check had to be mailed to the charity. And now what I'm seeing is the check is being made payable to the charity, but mailed to the taxpayer. And then the taxpayer delivers that check to the charity.
Got it. Right.
So I think the purpose of that is so that the charity can give them a receipt to make sure that they've documented it, because we still want a receipt because we want to be able to prove that indeed it did go to that charity, and that's why we're going to take it off page one of the income.
It's a great strategy, and it's a win-win. It's one of those strategies where everybody wins.
Right. And there's no income restriction or limitation on that, as when you're making a donation on Schedule A, you know, it's 30% of page one income if it's appreciated assets, or 50% if it's cash-like assets.
Right, right.
So that's another great way to do that. Folks, we are coming up on our last break. If you have questions, you can call in live on air or off air. We're training someone tonight, so we were kind of hoping we'd get a lot of calls so that we could do some proper training. So we have 15 minutes left. Phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to the show, and that was Otto, another volunteer here, making that announcement about the cars, and here Rod was just talking about that.
That's right, exactly. I was going to ask the question, how is that item, the car or the boat or whatever, valuated? Is it, you're giving it to a charity, you're not selling it to someone, so your example of maybe you sell the car for $500 doesn't hold with the charity.
Right, so the typical way, that's a good question, John, the typical way you're going to see it valued for purposes of the charitable deduction is for the what the charity is able to sell the car for. So you're relying on the, to some degree, on the charity to, you know, exercise a little bit of, you know, due diligence, I guess, in terms of what they're willing to sell the car for. Aside from that, like, you know, if you look into the details of these rules, you can get an appraisal of the car by a certified appraiser and use that to value the deduction. Used to be years ago, Lori, and I know you, as we go right to the blue book and look at the you know, average trade in value and the average resale value, and you know, maybe split the difference and print out a copy of the blue book and stick that in the tax file.
Those, and then I think the IRS got wise to some people whose cars probably didn't look so good to fall into that, or something happened there.
Yep.
Hey folks, we still have plenty of time. Phone number 610-758-8810. We're talking about tax questions. I have Rod Young in the studio with me this evening. We're both CPAs and CFPs, and happy to be a CPA and CFP, aren't you, Rod?
I am.
I just think it's a great combination because it just gives a whole nother level of financial advice, I think.
We worked hard for these.
Yes, we did. I will not argue with you on that. Many a night studying for comprehensive, complicated exams, but
absolutely,
we did it. And it's still very fresh in our memory, even though as young as we are, we still remember these things. A couple other items I thought would be important to talk about that some people may forget about, especially folks who prepare their own tax returns. Sometimes they just keep doing the same thing as last year. We have so many people who are self-employed. And if you're preparing your own tax return, maybe you think, oh, you know, I just run this little business. And you don't go back to those instructions like you used to, but some things have changed for self-employed people as far as some deductions that may help.
Sure.
So can you kind of touch on what I might be referring to?
Sure. I mean, one of the biggest deductions, aside from your normal, you know, you can offset your expenses against your income and you report your net self-employment income on a tax return, you know, one of the biggest deductions available to a self-employed individual is deducting the cost of their health insurance. And there's a lot that goes into that, though. Just, you know, what is the definition of health insurance in this day and age?
And where does it get deducted?
And where does it get deducted? So the nice thing here is if you the typical place that medical expenses, including insurance premiums, is deducted is on Schedule A of your tax return, except that on Schedule A, that's one of those pesky phase-outs where if your deductions don't exceed a certain threshold percentage of your gross income, 10% of your gross mm-hmm. income for most people, then you don't get any benefit of the deduction. So if you're self-employed, you can extract the portion of your medical expenses that are for premiums for health insurance and deduct those right on the front page of 1040. It reduces your gross income, helps in many different ways on mm-hmm. the tax return, and you're getting a full write-off for those costs.
And what is included in health insurance?
So the typical, you would expect that your health insurance premiums for, major medical, that would be included, and it is. Dental insurance, prescription mm-hmm. coverage, vision coverage, all includable. If you have long-term care insurance, and if it is a qualified long-term care policy, and we won't get into what the definition is of a qualified long-term care policy, but most long-term care insurance policies that are out in the market today are qualified long-term care. So the premiums for your long-term care insurance are eligible for this self-employed health
insurance
deduction.
I think that's one that's even hard for me to remember.
People miss it, I'm sure.
It really is hard to remember that because when we think of health insurance, we don't always think long-term
care. Long-term care, I agree. And then a big one, and that is also really been clarified within the past couple years, is, believe it or not, your Medicare premiums. Part A, Part D, Part C, they're
whatever you're paying through Medicare.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. withheld, so you don't really see it because you're not writing a check for it. It's withheld mm-hmm. Typically, it's withheld from your Social Security mm-hmm. benefits. That is part of the self-employed health insurance deduction.
And for the self-employed person, this deduction is for just themselves or their spouse or family? And what if their spouse has coverage?
Yeah,
through their own employer.
Right. So it's for their whole, typically it could be for their whole family. If their spouse has subsidized coverage through their employer, that is not part of the self-employed health insurance deduction. So this is for coverage that you're buying personally for your, it's for your business. But it doesn't have to be owned by the business or paid for by the business. You can pay for it yourself to be eligible for this deduction. If your insurance for your kids, what if your kid's in college? And how many semester tuition invoices do you see now where there's a line item for health insurance on the tuition bill? If it's a separately stated, mandated part of what you're required to pay the college, that would be eligible for self-employed health insurance
deduction.
Good
to know, and who looks at those?
Yeah. Typically, you can get out of those by proving that the college student's already...
Oh, has coverage.
Has coverage, yes.
So self-employed people who have a plan under their own name for themselves and or spouse and family, if there's not other coverage, other subsidized coverage or group coverage, and we found out COBRA does not count, folks.
Unfortunately, I don't like that rule, but it doesn't count. we don't have to like them all.
Right.
So.
So that's another big deduction on page one of the return. Now, that's not going to offset your net income that's going to be subject to self-employment tax, but it's certainly a big, big help because for years it wasn't there. And then when it was first allowed, it was like 50%,
yeah,
if I remembered right.
Yes.
Okay. We have a caller on line one. We have Jane in Allentown. Hello, Jane. Can you hear us?
Good. Yes. Hello. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Okay, my brother's disabled, and he gets Social Security disability.
Mm-hmm.
And someone told him that he needed to pay taxes. But unfortunately, he lost his information in a fire. So I'm having trouble finding the answer to the question. Does he really pay taxes?
Well, Jane, if he only has Social Security, then he shouldn't have to file if that's all he has.
Yeah, he doesn't have anything else with that.
No
other sources of income, Jane?
done right now.
No, no, that's not, that won't be taxable. He won't have to file.
Because the only way Social Security is even included in your income is based on all your other income. So, for example, my mother only has Social Security, and she does not have to file a tax return. Okay?
And there's some paper that he needs, that he should hold on to that says that.
Well, the IRS is aware. The IRS is aware of all the income that's being reported and his ID number. They'll know about the Social Security, but if there's no other income, they won't expect a tax return. And typically, they'll send a letter to recipients saying you really don't have to file a tax return, you know, unless you have some other income. Now, if your brother has Social Security disability and he sold a stock position that had gross proceeds of $100,000 and cost basis of $100,000, he still might not have any taxable income, but he might have to file a tax return to report the gross amount. But no, if he just has Social Security disability, even if he had a little interest, he probably wouldn't have to file. No, I think you're good.
Okay, and like his daughters get it too, so they don't have, there's something that he has to report because of that.
No.
That's what I thought, because he kept saying, no, I have to file a tax return.
No,
I'm like, I don't think so.
No.
You can tell them you talk to the experts.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, Jane. Take care. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Have a good night. You too.
I appreciate the phone calls tonight, folks. How about multi-state filings? What do we want to watch for? We have like 4 minutes left. We can talk about multi-state issues. And Frank and I touched on this last week a little bit with our New Jersey folks.
Sure.
But it's beyond just New Jersey. I mean, we're having more and more multi-state returns.
States are hungry for revenue. And so if you have any kind of earning activity within a state that you don't live in, there's a chance that sometime in the future, if not sooner rather than later, they're going to expect you to report that income to their state.
Mm-hmm.
We see it, someone who's works for a major sports league and travels around the country working in different locations, ends up filing tax returns in 10 or 12 different states that they work in for the major sports league.
So the employer is issuing them a W-2, showing
the
all the...
longest W-2 I've ever seen. No. Yeah. Multi-page W-2 reporting how much was earned in each state. And so the big thing to then be aware of is, sure, you're having to file tax returns in all these different states, which does add to the complexity of your tax filing. But then for your resident state, the state that you live in, you're not going to get double taxed. You get to take a credit. So if you're a Pennsylvania resident and you're working in New York State and pay some tax to New York State, you're going to get a credit up to the amount of your Pennsylvania tax for that tax that you paid to New York State, so that you're not double taxed on it. And that's the big thing to watch out for, is be aware that you're allowed it's typically called a resident credit for these taxes paid to other states.
I think we're going to see this more too, because I know that there has been all kinds of talk about, and I don't recall like what the name is that they put to it, it's common reporting or something, I don't remember what it was, but more states are wanting employers to track when their employees are working
in different locations.
Yeah.
We're seeing more and more of it.
So hopefully someone will figure out how to do easier reporting for people, because it could be very costly, like your gentleman who had the 18K1s and it took 3 hours. If you have 12 states' returns, now granted, when we use software, it works out pretty well, but sometimes the software will kick out a return from electronic filing when you have too many activities.
Absolutely.
So then you're talking about a tax preparer possibly having to print all of those tax returns, because we have to opt out when we're not electronically filing.
Right.
So it takes a lot
it
of
adds
extra
to
time.
Complexity, without a doubt.
So folks, when you take those jobs, be careful of where you might be working. It's not too bad between New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. We're so used to that.
We have a lot of Pennsylvania, New Jersey is very simple because of for the most part, because of the reciprocal agreement between the states. But it's it definitely adds the level of complexity.
And Frank was on last week. For anyone listening from New Jersey, if you didn't hear the show last week, you can go on WDIY.org and listen to the podcast. We were talking about differences in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and making sure if we have New Jersey residents living and working in Pennsylvania and you're paying local taxes, that's going to be a credit on your New Jersey return. Rod, we're running out of time, so thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Lori. I always love being here.
Yeah,
with you.
You do a great job. Thank you for being here and filling in for me when I'm not. How do people reach you?
They can reach me at 610-868-9000 or ryoung@valleynationalgroup.com.
Great, and I'm sure you'll hear from Rod in the upcoming months when he fills in when I'm running around. So thank you,
you so much for being here.
I'll
be back.
And thank you, listeners. Thank you, Judy Ann and Lori, for being here tonight. John, thank you for being here tonight. And thank you, listeners, for calling in with the questions. We really appreciate it. Next week, I'm going to talk about filing for extensions, estimated tax payments, owing the IRS, just some nuances around that. Coming up next, Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive, and make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week.